Case of the day is another criminal, United States versus Smoot. Mr. Meade.
May it please the court, Your Honor.
Good to have you, sir.
Thank you. My name is Chris Meade, and with my colleague Lance Robinson, we have the privilege of being appointed by this court to represent the defendant, Charles Smoot, and the appellant in this case. I'd like to begin where I should have begun our brief, with the second issue in our brief, which is the Sixth Amendment interstate nexus jury instruction issue. And I'd like to begin with a discussion of the Second Circuit's case in United States v. Parks, because if Parks is right, this conviction must be overturned and the government is wrong. Parks, if you'll recall, was a mini en banc case out of the Second Circuit. It was a Hobbs Act case. And what happened was the defendants robbed a marijuana dealer in New York City. The robbery went bad. One of them shot and killed the man. Three defendants were charged with a Hobbs Act violation. Remember that the element of the Hobbs Act is that it has to be a robbery affecting commerce, the very same test of felon in possession. My client's possession had to be affecting commerce. That was a post-Gordon case. Even post-Gordon, the Second Circuit had a panel opinion that was in effect at the time the district court was dealing with this trial. That panel opinion had held that even though Gordon said that every element must be presented to a jury, the Hobbs Act affecting commerce was an issue of law for the court. So that's what the district court was wrestling with as this case went to trial. And the government presented the district court with a jury instruction that is precisely identical to the standard Sand and Siffert instruction on gun possession. And this is, it's literally quoted on page 45 of the government's brief. It's right there. They only spend one paragraph on Parks. And that paragraph actually tells you all you need to know about why we're right. Because the government proposed a jury instruction based on that panel, controlling panel opinion of the Second Circuit that said, if you find that the object of this robbery was to rob illegal narcotics, then the interstate commerce requirement is satisfied. The exact same instruction in Sand and Siffert. In our case, it was if the gun has ever traveled across a state line, the interstate nexus element is satisfied. So Parks and our case literally are identical. Now, the district court, to his credit, wrestled back and forth with this. And after the government closed its case, the district court said, you know, I'm troubled by this. I'm going to give a jury instruction that doesn't instruct the jury that all they have to do is find that the object was to rob a pot dealer. They have to find that that affected interstate commerce. The government was surprised by this. And they asked for the opportunity to reopen. The district court exercised its discretion and allowed the government to reopen, and they put on a law enforcement officer who gave evidence about the interstate impact of even a local pot dealer in New York City. And the jury, instructed on that element of the offense, convicted. Now, on appeal, what happened was that the defense said, first, the evidence was insufficient, and second, you shouldn't have allowed the government to reopen the case. And the panel said to themselves, I'm sure, and this is why they polled the entire court. They said to themselves, we don't have to consider the sufficiency of the evidence or the reopening if the law is as the government says it is. If the object was to rob a pot dealer, that satisfies interstate nexus ipso facto, as the court said. But the court said, we don't believe that's the law. We want to overrule our wrong panel precedent. They polled the court. They got unanimous consent from every member of the Second Circuit. And they said, you know, the government's jury instruction is wrong because it's not enough. It's not enough for a jury just to decide facts. This is a mixed question of law and fact. And as Gordon says, and all the cases that have followed Gordon say, mixed questions of law and fact must be presented to a jury. They must not just decide whether the gun traveled across the state line, which is all my jury was asked to do. They must decide whether that fact, also applying the law to those facts, is sufficient to prove that my client's possession of a firearm that crossed a state line 35 years before was in or affecting commerce. Dead on point. The government doesn't say Parks was wrongly decided. They don't quibble with your opinion, Judge King, where you said jurisdictional elements of these statutes are essential elements. They have to be proven to a jury. Jury's got to be properly instructed. The government literally doesn't disagree with us on the law. You know, their only argument is, look at the jury instruction that was given in this case, and the jury had the opportunity to decide this question, to apply the law to the facts. And all I can say is factually, no, it didn't. Not a chance. First, remember that the government's motion in limine was granted, precluding me from standing up in front of the jury and saying, the fact that a gun crossed the state line 35 years ago is not sufficient to prove 35 years later that my client's possession was in or affecting commerce. I wasn't able to argue that to the jury. I wasn't able to question witnesses about it. So, and the judge's jury instruction, the standard sand instruction, is clear as a bell. First two paragraphs tell the jury twice, if the gun crossed a state line, that's enough to satisfy the interstate nexus, just like Parks did. The third paragraph, which the government points at, is the kind of standard stuff that you see about inferences. So it's designed for a case that's actually different than ours, right? Because in ours, we actually had a custodian of records from the gun manufacturer in Massachusetts who testified, we've got records. This gun was sold 35 years ago from our shop in Massachusetts to a gun store in Maryland. There's the proof. It was actually transported. They had direct proof. The third paragraph, though, of Sand and Siffert deals with the utterly routine way that all these felon in possession cases get litigated, which is the government can prove where the gun was made, and they can prove it's possessed in a different state.
And it had to get there by crossing state lines.
Right. And so the third paragraph of Sand and Siffert simply says to the jury, it is permissible to draw an inference that the fact that it was made in one place and is found in another means that it crossed a state line, but you don't necessarily have to draw that inference. Now, the government takes that sentence completely out of context, ignores the first two paragraphs of the instruction, and says, see, despite the fact that defense counsel wasn't allowed to argue this to the jury, despite the fact that the first two paragraphs told them that all you need to do is have a gun travel across the state line, see, the jury actually got to decide this issue. That's just factually, grossly wrong. I mean, you need no more than to look at the government's motion in limine and the judge's ruling, which told me in no uncertain terms, Mr. Mead, the fact that it crossed the state line is enough. It's literally the only relevant evidence I will admit at trial. You're not allowed to ask, and you're not allowed to argue that that's not enough. And that is a constitutional violation of my client's Sixth Amendment jury trial rights. Now, I want to make it absolutely clear what I'm not arguing, because I'm aware of the limits of what I can argue and what I can't based on this court's precedent. I am aware that judges of this court have said repeatedly that the bare fact that a gun traveled across the state line at any time in the past is sufficient to support conviction. Those minimal facts are sufficient to support conviction. So that if, for example, on these facts, I had been given an opportunity to
pursue a conviction that requires proof of the element that it was in interstate commerce.
Correct.
So now, which case are you talking about? You talking about the Gallimore case?
Yeah, for example. I mean, literally, this circuit has repeatedly rejected commerce clause.
So it says evidence to show that it was manufactured in another state and it is now here is sufficient.
This court has said that is minimally sufficient to support conviction. But that is different than saying you get to direct a verdict on it. Now, I would argue to you that your precedents are wrong. I mean, I'm sorry, but there's a limit to what I can argue. In other words, this case...
There's also the limit to what we can do with those precedents.
what we can do to them.
Oh, right. So all I'm saying is I'm not asking you to overturn the precedent you have, which says, so the only point I'm trying to make is, if I had an opportunity to argue to the jury and ask questions about the impact on interstate commerce of my client's possession of a gun that had traveled across the state line 35 years earlier, and the jury had been instructed, as I asked them to be, that even a minimal impact on interstate commerce is enough, and the fact that it traveled across the state line be sufficient.
I need some help on that, because go back to the Gallimore case. The language it uses is, under existing circuit precedent, the government may establish the requisite interstate commerce nexus by showing that a firearm was manufactured outside of the state where the defendant possessed it.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
If we follow that, how do you win?
Oh, it's easy. For example,
you can't argue to the jury that they can change the law.
Oh, no, I'm not even talking about that. All that says is that's the minimum evidence necessary.
I didn't see the word minimum in it at all. It says the government may establish the requisite interstate commerce nexus.
May.
Oh.
But, Your Honor, here's the point. Here's the point.
Or they may do it some other way.
But all of your...
this is one way they can do it.
All of your sufficiency of evidence cases, all of them. I used in my brief an example of constructive possession of a gun in a car. Okay? It is minimally sufficient. The government may establish possession by the driver of a gun found under the driver's seat by the fact that he's in the car and it's under the driver's seat. That evidence is minimally sufficient to convict.
I'm trying to understand the import of this word may and trying to figure out, well, how could they have said it show you that was a way? I mean, you wouldn't say shall establish. You just said that's one way they can do it.
Right.
And it clearly is a way that can be done. And that, I mean, I understand where you're going with your argument. I'm not in disagreement, but I'm just trying to put it in light of what we have here, that this just makes it pretty simple. In terms of how to establish interstate nexus, they show the firearm was manufactured. Here the evidence shows it was assembled in Massachusetts, and we're talking about Maryland.
Right. So if a jury found that those, if a jury properly instructed, accorded my client his Sixth Amendment rights, the jury instruction I proposed said that may be enough. The fact that it crossed the state line may be enough. A proper jury instruction would probably have to say that. The proper jury instruction would say the impact can only be slight. But those are the jury instructions that are offered in Hobbs Act cases all the time. Those interstate nexus jury instructions are offered in every other context where interstate nexus is at issue in trials other than gun possession. This is a bizarre kind of wormhole in the law where nobody has paid attention to the Sixth Amendment and felon in possession stuff. I don't know why not. In Hobbs Act cases, juries are instructed about interstate nexus. I see my lights on, Your Honor, but minimal evidence is not the same as I don't get to argue it's not enough. You can establish conviction of murder with one snitch's testimony. That doesn't mean the defense doesn't get to argue and the jury doesn't get to consider.
Thank you, sir. Now, you haven't argued your Heller point, which was your leading point in your brief. Are you giving that up?
I am not, Your Honor,
right,
but...
give you opportunity to say that.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Vitarelli? I don't suppose you agree with that.
Excuse me?
I don't suppose you agree with Mr. Beat's proposition.
No, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. Anthony Vitarelli for the United States. I'd start with where Mr. Mead left off, which is the second issue that he raised in his brief. And I think it's critical to look actually at how the jury was instructed in this case. We quote the relevant language at page 40 of our red brief. Essentially, on the question of the interstate element of the 922 G1 conviction, the jury received an instruction in three parts. The first part, the district court instructed the jury that the government has offered some evidence that the gun was manufactured in Massachusetts and was subsequently possessed in Maryland. Second, the district court stated as a matter of black letter Fourth Circuit law that showing that a gun had been manufactured in another state other than the state of possession permits the jury to infer that interstate commerce had been affected. And third, critically, the jury was instructed that it did not have to do so. From that third critical instruction, the matter was left in the, to the jury's determination. It was not, it did not receive a directed verdict. The jury was left to conclude, as a matter of fact, whether the government's evidence had sufficiently proven the interstate nexus element of the crime. Additionally, if there were any doubt as to that legal conclusion, there is no question that that error would have been harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. As Gonzalez-Lopez made clear, this is not a kind of structural error. This plainly would be subject to harmlessness error review. And under Gallimore and this court's various precedents, it is sufficient for the government to show that the gun had been manufactured in another state and had been transferred to Maryland. That evidence was undisputed. The government's expert was cross-examined lightly, but there was no evidence or even representation that the gun had not been manufactured outside of Maryland. So that would have been harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in any event.
Do you believe that, or from your position, is it possible for an item that is in affecting interstate commerce to lose its character?
No.
So once that is, once it's manufactured in one state and it's another, I don't care where you use it, wherever, from for the rest of the time, because 100 years from now, it will affect interstate commerce.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that is the law of the circuit.
And it cannot, there's no such thing as stopping the interstate movement of it.
No, there is no such thing.
So you maintain the instruction that they requested was just wrong.
Our position is that it was wrong. There's no case of this court that says expressly that it is wrong, but there is equally.
Well, you just said it. They say they wanted, you may also consider whether the firearm had lost its interstate commerce or stopped its interstate movement. I mean, that seems to be the key from my perspective, what this could mean. You could argue, yeah, it was manufactured up there, but that doesn't mean anything now. It's no longer affecting interstate commerce.
That's correct. That's our position.
And you say that's wrong.
That is incorrect.
It cannot be manufactured in another state and then thereafter be in the state that's at hand and not affect interstate commerce. That's, as a matter of law.
As a matter of law, Your Honor, that's correct. And to my knowledge, no case has ever so said.
No case has ever what?
Has never reached the conclusion that was formed the basis of Judge Wynn's hypothetical.
The doctrine of attenuation doesn't apply.
Not as far as satisfying the interstate nexus element, no, Your Honor.
Okay. What's the import of the Parks case? Sorry, Judge.
Well, the parties don't really agree or don't really disagree as to the significance of Gowden, Arimony, Terry, Parks, the cases that are cited by Smoot and discussed in the government's brief. Where the difference is what the jury in this case was actually instructed. We acknowledge that the third element of 922 G1, that Smoot's possession affected interstate commerce, is a question that the jury must conclude that the government's evidence proved beyond a reasonable doubt. In this case, the jury made that conclusion. Because Mr. Smoot preserved his Second Amendment argument, if I might address it just for a brief moment, Moore controls here for two reasons. First, like Moore, Smoot's criminal history removes him from the class of law-abiding, responsible citizens protected by the core of the Second Amendment. And second, like Moore, Smoot's claim that he possessed the firearm for purposes of self-defense is too unsubstantiated to overcome 922 G1's presumed lawfulness. Because this case is materially indistinguishable from Moore, Smoot's as-applied challenge must fail.
And Moore came out after you all filed your briefs here.
That's correct, Your Honor, but we submitted a 28-J letter discussing Moore on January 26th. And in the absence of any other questions.
Judge Traxler?
No, thanks.
We would submit on our briefs. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Mr. Meade?
I'm delighted by the concession from the United States that the jury had to decide the mixed question of law and fact as to whether the fact that a firearm was transported across a state line 35 years ago satisfies interstate nexus. Under this court's precedence, I agree that those facts arguably are sufficient to support conviction as the minimum facts to support conviction. In other words,
tell me an instance in which, if a firearm is manufactured in another state and possessed in the state here, that it would not affect interstate commerce.
Well, what I would say to you, Your Honor, is that many federal judges have written opinions on analogous circumstances. For example,
I want to know, have any on this court written such an opinion?
No, but
because it seems pretty clear that at least the May that you imported here seems to be kind of the law, and I'm just trying to get some understanding. But you say arguably, and it could be, and the jury has to find. But if the only conclusion can be that if something is manufactured in Massachusetts and possessed in Maryland, that is affecting interstate commerce, then tell me how it cannot. Oh, I mean, what else could a jury find other than jury nullification? What else could they find?
Oh, absolutely not. In other words, if I argue to most Federalist Society members about whether the possession of an article that once traveled in interstate commerce and is now found inside a private residence or a private business that does not conduct commerce outside the state, most of those learned people, reasonable human beings, would say, no, that is not affecting interstate commerce within the meaning of the United States Constitution. And the interstate commerce nexus in this firearm statute is specifically designed to be the coextensive extension of the Interstate Commerce Clause. For example, members of the Supreme Court, up until 1933, all would have said there is no impact on interstate commerce and Congress can't regulate contracts between employees in intrastate businesses. Those are reasonable people. You put a jury of 12, I don't believe it affects interstate commerce. Tell me how my guy's possession of a firearm that traveled across the state line 35 years ago affects interstate commerce. He's not selling it.
I don't want to argue the point because I think you make good points, but I want to deal with what the precedent is in this circuit. And as much as I like to be able to make the law what I want it to be, or that, oh, no, it doesn't look like to me. I mean, if you ask me personally, no, it doesn't look like to me it's affecting interstate commerce. Those words don't seem to apply to something that happened 35 years ago.
Right.
But this law is pretty clear, and that's kind of how you got to get me off of this thing, saying, Judge Wynn, you shouldn't be following the law. You got to tell me why, how to distinguish what the law is in this circuit in light of the cases that we have and in light of what was instructed here. And I did bring up one point I do want to ask, because in asking for a jury instruction, you have to ask what is correct. The government says it is incorrect to assert that once it is manufactured in one state and then moved to another state, that it can lose its interstate commerce affectation. Is that true?
No, it's crazy. It's absolutely insane.
It can lose it.
Of course. And the Ninth Circuit has said so. And I cited the case in my brief. Of course it can lose its interstate commerce characteristic.
So that's what this is all about. You're saying it doesn't necessarily have to. It can lose its interstate or it... Another statement you said, stop the movement of it. How does that play come into play? That can happen too?
Well, look, if the government can prove...
It came to rest in Maryland, is that what you're going to say?
I'm sorry?
It came to rest in Maryland 35 years ago?
Yeah. If the government could prove that it came from Massachusetts 35 years ago, but my client had it and was driving it into Virginia, now maybe it's in interstate commerce. Maybe. I think reasonable minds could differ, but that's my point about it stopping. The government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury of 12, properly instructed, more than just the minimal facts. I mean, Judge, all I can tell you is look carefully at Gallimore. Gallimore doesn't say, as a matter of law, anytime the government proves that, the guy's convicted. In fact, the Department of Justice lawyer knows he doesn't want you saying that. You heard him admit, No, Judge, we concede that this is a jury question. All we're saying is this jury was instructed and actually made that decision. He is not saying Gallimore.
Is the jury question the fact of whether it was manufactured somewhere
or
whether it was possessed here?
No, those two facts are undisputed. What Park says and what Gauden says is this is a mixed question of law and fact. The facts are made in Massachusetts 35 years ago, found in Maryland today. Those are the facts.
Undisputed.
Undisputed facts. A jury must apply the law to the facts in a mixed question of law and fact. And that's what Gauden said. That's what Park said. In other words, if Gauden said the jury, all the jury has to decide are the facts, that it was a false statement to that bank, Gauden doesn't exist. You know, that's not, What Gauden said is they have to decide also that it was material and they have to be instructed about what material means. I mean, Your Honor, on this minimum evidence necessary to convict, if the government's sole witness in a murder case was a snitch who had been offered probation for saying that this guy did the shooting, a jury would laugh him out of court, right? He'd be acquitted, hopefully, if that's the only evidence. But if a jury convicted and the trial was proper and procedurally valid, and we came up here to you, and all I had to argue was sufficiency of the evidence, you would say that, hey, the jury heard a witness who gave direct testimony that the defendant killed the guy. That is sufficient for conviction. You would never say to me, defense lawyer, that means you can't cross-examine the snitch, you can't argue that the snitch is lying, you can't contradict direct testimony that the guy did the killing.
Isn't there a distinction, though, in terms of whether you're talking about ultimate facts that are not in dispute as opposed to facts that you can play with?
Mixed questions.
I mean,
sure.
Here you have ultimate facts. I mean, you got a fact manufactured in Massachusetts, possessed in Maryland. Conclusion has to be.
Oh, no. No, first of all, again.
It had to travel from Maryland or Massachusetts to Maryland.
Sure.
And you would have us write in some restriction on the timing of the travel, that it had to be recent travel or something.
No.
Rather than travel 25, 30 years ago.
I'm sorry, but I believe a properly instructed jury of 12 might respectfully disagree with the members of this court. You guys are making a factual determination. I'm sorry, but that's what you're doing. You are saying...
No.
So you want to have the jury nullification.
No, it's not nullification.
No, we got this red light on.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
We're giving you a lot of chance.
But I do need you to help me on that. And I'm just trying to understand your point on that, because you seem to be very forceful in it. Two ultimate facts. One's in Maryland. It is manufactured in Maryland. Possessed in Maryland. What other conclusion can you reach? How is it not in interstate commerce?
Economists would disagree about this, Your Honor.
I understand that. But I want to deal with the law in terms of the way the law is set up. It's
what is the other legal conclusion you can derive from that that would establish that it's not? Is it because, what's the basis of saying? Because in most instances, generally you would agree, yes, that is interstate
commerce. Oh, no, I wouldn't. I think you guys are dead wrong.
Oh.
But look, that's an issue where all you all have said is that a properly instructed jury can say that is the minimum necessary for conviction. If I got a chance to argue in front of all of you and you had to vote as a jury, I'd present an economist. I'd cross-examine the government's economist. I'd ask you to use your common sense. I think you guys are dead wrong. I don't think that my guy possessing a gun that traveled across a state line 35 years ago.
Well, we don't know when it traveled. It might have traveled across the state line the week before they arrested him.
And if the government can prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, if that's in evidence, great.
But the statute says it has to be in there. It doesn't say when.
No, the statute says nothing about the gun traveling across the state line. It says the possession must be in or affecting commerce.
Interstate commerce. It doesn't put a time restriction on it.
Right. It says it has to be affecting commerce right now. Well, not 35 years ago, right now. I'm sorry.
We really appreciate your work here, and we commend you, your court-appointed counsel, and we commend you for your work and your effort, and we appreciate it very much. And we'll take the matter under advisement. Unless Judge Traxler has something further.
No, thank you, Judge King, Judge Wynn.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll come down to brief counsel and adjourn for the day.
This honorable court stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30. God save the United States and this honorable court.